This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy Nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
Do you have weak, damaged hair? New Garnier Fructis hair filler systems fill hair with strength 7 layers deep. In just one use, you can reverse up to 1 year of damage to hair smoothness. The sulfate-free hair filler plus vitamin CG system gives you up to 79% stronger hair and up to 4 times less breakage. New Garnier Fructis hair filler is available now on Amazon and at Walmart, Target, Ulta, Drug, and select grocery stores.
You're listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Science Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling science and technology monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.
Hello and welcome to the Science Focus podcast. I'm Jason Goodger, commissioning editor at BBC Science Focus magazine. Today I'm talking to Carl Strathern, a roboticist and research fellow the School of Computing at Edinburgh Napier University. He's currently conducting research on realistic human robots, specifically on more realistically synchronizing their speech and mouth movements. So thanks very much for joining us today, Carl.
No problem.
So yeah, just as by way of background, sort of one of the big talking points or maybe even driving factors behind research on you know, realistic human robotics is this so-called uncanny valley effect. So sort of before we get into the actual meat of your work, can you just explain to the people listening what that is if they're unfamiliar with it?
Yes, the uncanny valley is a point where things like robots, humanoid robots and CGI characters start to give us an eerie feeling. And the reason for that is because they are not perfect representations of humans. They never quite get there, and because they never quite get there, they emit these feelings of terror, unease, unfriendliness, and that's the uncanny valley. It's kind of, they call it a perceptual dip, which is basically they call it a point between being alive and being dead, basically. It's this kind of zombie, this idea of a zombie in between the two, and humanoid robots and CGI characters, because they inhibit similar kind of qualities of a zombie, fall into the uncanny valley.
Yeah, I'd like to say, like, it sits somewhere between Wall-E, like your sort of cute robot, and then the T-1000 from Terminator 2.
Yeah.
So what's the sort of current thinking on the psychology? What's going on here? Why does this why do people find these sort of human but not completely human robots a bit, you know, a bit iffy, a bit creepy?
I think it's because from birth we're able to detect faces and we're able to analyze faces, and faces play such an important part in our communication. And when we start to see things that shouldn't be there, out of place, we do get that feeling of, in kind of, it's called repulsion, but I guess It's just, I call it negative feedback. Like, it's unnatural feedback. And one of the arguments, recent arguments that have come to light, is that this is starting to also occur in facial enhancement surgery. So people who have, you know, their lips kind of enhanced and things like that. This can be considered as sort of the higher realms of the uncanny valley. If I was to build a robot and it had sort of these enhancements, and I said, oh, I'm trying to make it as real as possible, people might say, well, it doesn't look completely real because you've added these enhancements. So on a kind of perceptual level, we consider that as the higher realms of the uncanny valley. There's other types of uncanny valley as well. It's not just appearance, it's in functionality as well, the way things move, the way robots move. If a robot doesn't move the way we kind of expect it to move, then again, that gives that feeling of unnaturalness, uneasiness, and that is kind of the emphasis of the uncanny valley effect.
Yeah, I remember there's the Atlas robot, and I just thought that was amazing and really fascinating, but other people, they're sort of pushing him over and he's recovering his balance, and, you know, some people are saying, oh, you know, that thing's going to turn on you.
But that's purely just because it looks and behaves like a human. And because the human drive is, if we see something that looks and behaves or anything kind of like a human, we automatically start saying, well, it must be able to feel and think and have emotions like a human when it doesn't. So it's that drive again, that kind of innate drive.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So sort of moving on to your sort of the role you play in this. So you focus on speech, matching facial movements to speech. So why is that important? Why does that play such an important role in this effect?
Well, when I started, this all started from the uncanny valley theorem. And the two key areas in the uncanny valley theorem are eyes and the mouth. And when we communicate, our attention goes between the eyes and the mouth. We look at eyes to gauge attention, and we look at mouth for speech reading, for understanding. And with robots particularly, anything that is kind of outside the realm of them natural lip movements, when the speech is so perfectly coming out, it can be confusing and disorientating, especially if you're kind of interacting over a certain amount of time for a length of time. I think they also saw this in one of the recent Star Wars remakes, when they did a CGI character and the lip synchronization was kind of off. But that's where this project started, really. It started off with, how can I turn systems that are used in CGI animation and games to turn speech into something called visemes, which is kind of the lip positions. How can I take that software and create it for a robot? How can I turn this into a robot? Right. That's where that started, really. So when I was first doing this project, I was actually helping teach in the animation department at the time, because the previous university I was at didn't quite have a robotics department. So that's where these ideas started to come together, because they use programs. There's one called Oculus, which basically it takes speech and it converts it into a CGI mouth with lip positions. So it automatically reads speech and extracts the visemes for the mouth positions. And I want to do that with the robot. So to start with, I created a robot mouth. And the robot mouth was modeled on the human mouth. But before I did that, I looked at previous robotic mouth systems to see what was missing. And that was kind of really important, just to be able to see what are the key muscles, what muscles work together, what can be left out of this mouth. Because obviously, it's a very small area, and you kind of confined to what you can actually put into a robotic mouth. Yeah. One of the key things that was missing was something called the buccinator muscles, which are the muscles at the corners of the mouth, and not the cheek muscles, but the corners of the mouth, and they are used for pursing and stretching the lips when we create vowel and consonant sounds. So I replicated these muscles, and I created this kind of robotic mouth prototype, and I thought, right, the next stage is to create an application that can take these lip shapes and put them into this robotic mouth. So we use something called avising chat, and it's something that's used a lot in CGI and game design, which is basically a list of sounds, word sounds and letter sounds, and the mouth shape, the matching mouth shape. And I made my robot do these shapes. So for each, like the A's, R's and O's, all these robotic mouth positions I collected and saved into a configuration file to be able to bring them out later and use them. And the next part was how to create a system that can handle speech. Now, previously in the other applications, the speech was kind of a secondary thing. You spoke and then you put it into a file into the application and it read the file. I need to do it live. I couldn't. There was no room to kind of have some processing time, because if you use processing time, then this idea of speech becomes unnatural. The conversation, you know, there's lots of huge pauses in the conversation, which is unnatural. So it's what I did. I created a machine learning algorithm, and I was able to take speech synthesis, which is robotic speech like you have on Siri and various other applications. Take that speech synthesis out of a laptop and put one end of it into something called a microprocessor and turn that audio data back into numerical data. And the other part of it also went back into a processing system, so I could actually see the sound wave like you see on a normal, like in a recording studio. And then is what I did is I created a machine learning algorithm that could kind of recognize patterns in the incoming speech. And that was done not by monitoring the speech itself as such, but the patterns in the waveform. So you're looking at kind of the pixel size and the length of each word and each sound. And then basically feeding the system a bunch of samples. So it kind of knew what it was looking for. And when it came across it, it was able to transfigure the robot mouth system to match to the positions that I matched on the chart. And that worked surprisingly well. And then the next thing was, the voice, what I call the voice patterning system, which is syllables. So obviously when you talk, the syllables, your drum moves up and down to syllables. And that was kind of the next stage, to create this patterning system if there was no sound, the mouth was shut, the louder the sound, the wider the robot mouth. And then there was tongue positions as well. So there was tongue positions to include. And then when I actually put it all together, it was pretty amazing to see work. It was like we're talking about the Uncanny Valley. I think for one of the first times I actually sat with a robot, and it was very strange to see, because, you know, you see all these weird parts working together. It was good once it was kind of configured and the system was trained. It was really quite accurate in some respects. In the lip synchronization, it was very accurate. In some other parts, it wasn't. But it held up pretty well in the evaluation against existing robots.
So for those who haven't seen your work, your robot, so it's a pretty realistic looking head. And it's a head of an older gent. How did you go about choosing your character for your robot? I just find that really interesting.
Well, there's actually two robots in the experiment. There was an older-looking one and a younger-looking robot. The younger-looking robot doesn't get as much attention because I think the older-looking robot looks more realistic. But they were both kind of produced with the idea of being... One was a younger version of the older one. So they were both kind of the same robot. And when I was doing the tests, because the mouth test was part of a wider test which involved lots of different things like eyes and personality. So I wanted to compare how people interacted with an older looking robot and a younger looking robot. And I had two sample groups. I had a sample group of older people and younger people. And what I found is that younger people preferred to interact with the younger robot and the older people preferred to interact with the older looking robot. And there was also personalities as well. So I had to design an older personality and then a younger personality. So I thought, well, I'm quite young, so I'll build the younger personality on myself. So I, my interest, and I thought, well, I know my dad pretty well, and he's kind of old, so I modelled the older one on him. So I had one that was kind of interested in what I'm interested in. Everyone was interested in snooker and John Smith's, so it was quick.
That's really interesting. Have there been any sort of like big studies done on what the public or people who are going to be interacting with these robots would like them to look like?
No, I'm not too sure about robots. There certainly was in CGI characters, but I actually wrote a paper just on this subject, which was designing robots, and I call it embodied artificial intelligence, which is the personality of robots. And it's really fascinating. Actually, there was a robot called Bina 48, which was modelled on somebody. It was supposed to be act as like a vessel for her. So it's like a collection of her memories and life experiences. But in terms of like actual academic research, there was very little to go on. One interesting thing that I'm starting to really realise now is that there's been a huge movement away from academia into the private sector. So we have like Hanson Robotics and Sophia. And in England, we have Engineered Arts, and they have their robots, their humanoid robots. And in Japan, they have the Geminoid series. And Russia have a new one called Promobot, which again is realistic humanoid robots for things like desk assistants and receptionists and things like that. So,
Yeah, so just sort of going into the nuts and bolts of your work. So you're saying that it's got lips, teeth, tongue, jawbones, different facial actuating muscles. So what's it actually made of?
It was all 3D printed. I because it was a rapid prototype, and there's so many different versions of it that the whole system was 3D printed. But then some parts of it. Couldn't really stand up to the pressures of the mouth working all the time, so I had to have them CNC'd in a special aluminium composite, which is kind of very thin, very light material. I think eventually is what I am hoping to do is be able to publish all this online, kind of open source, and let people, you know, create their own prototypes and expand on the system, because, you know, it has a high accuracy, but it's not totally accurate. And so there's still work there to be done, but because I've kind of moved on now to other stuff, you know, I want to leave it to the public. Well, engineers and robots are interested in that to kind of expand on.
Yeah. So what was the design process like then? Like, what was your starting point and your initial goal?
My initial goal was to replicate the human mouth as closely as possible. The speech synthesis was difficult to deal with because we don't have accurate speech synthesis, and I don't think it's ever really going to sound truly human, because human speech is so variable. I think that's why my system works so well, because with speech synthesis you can control that. With human speech you can't. So if I was to speak into my machine learning application and try and get the robot to replicate, it's not going to do that. Speech synthesis is very controlled. If it's not totally controlled, but there are limitations to it, and you can kind of work within these parameters to get really good results. So one of the other interesting points and the reasons why I designed it like I designed it was because I knew from my experience that previously the humanoid robots out there like Sophia, they do not use these kind of technologies. They simply have random jaw movements to sound, and sometimes they do it very well. They tend to do it very quickly, so it's hard to see exactly. So when you do things quickly and the speech is kind of at its normal pace, then there is a little bit of scope there for almost it tricks the human brain. It tends to be if the lips are going slower, then, you know, you kind of see that. But if things are going faster, you tend not to notice it too much. And I really wanted to see if I could kind of improve on all this. So from my studies, I was able to determine that using things like machine learning is a lot more accurate and definitely the way to go to be doing these things, rather than kind of just randomized lip movements and positions and things.
Yeah, that's really, because going back to you were saying about CGI and video games, like I've recently noticed, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I really like Demon's Souls and Dark Souls, those games. And they recently did a sort of revamp of Demon's Souls, which is quite old, for the PlayStation 5. And one of the things that was vastly improved was the synchronization of the characters as they were speaking, like with their mouths. It looked so much more natural than previously, when it was sort of like a badly dubbed, 80s movie or something.
Yeah.
So is that's like similar to the stuff you've been working on previously?
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much hit the nail on the head. But I'd also say that, imagine at the time when you were playing them video games the first time around, you might not have noticed that as much. Or if you did notice it, you kind of thought, probably. well, it's still really good. It's still a really good attempt. But with humanoid robotics, it's different because they're in front of you. They're there. CGI characters, they get away with a lot because they are there. When you have a robot in a room in front of you, there's very little hiding places for these things, and you're able to kind of really pick out things that are going wrong and things that are unnatural. And that's one of the things that really came about in my studies was how people have this kind of inbuilt ability to recognize things that are not quite right, and what you might think is a tiny thing can actually give the whole game away, especially when we're considering I wrote another kind of model, an idea called the multimodal Turing test. It's been also now dubbed the Westworld test, which is basically when you create a robot and it gets to the point where you can no longer tell the difference between the robot and the human, things like that. And what goes into that as well, so it was kind of a model that it's based on like a triangle, like a hierarchy. And the closer you get to the top, the harder it is, of course, to actually get these nuances, these things, and things like lip synchronization. Pupil dilation is another area I've worked on, robotic pupil dilation.
Right.
It's these tiny nuances that play a huge part in it, because these are the things that give the game away, and things like facial tics or whatever, just these tiny nuances that we don't even realize are important in a conversation suddenly become crucial.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So sort of Westworld, I'd forgotten about that actually. I really enjoyed that. So what are the potential applications of this type of work? What's the end goal? What do we want to do with it?
For me, I always use the example of Data from Star Trek as the perfect example for this, because Data, he acts as like this very humanistic interface between lots of different things. It acts as an interface between people and aliens. So obviously aliens that don't speak English, and he acts as a translator. But not only that, he also acts as an interface between things like the computer and a person. So things that would be very difficult, calculations that would be very difficult, he's able to translate that information and give it in a very simplified way, but in a very humanistic way, with emotion, with facial expressions. And that's where I think this technology will eventually head towards. I mean, we have to remember that not everybody can interact with technology effectively. We're very privileged, I think, to have grown up with technology and to be able to use technology, but there's lots of people in the world who don't have that. And creating something like a humanoid robot would allow them to kind of integrate with technology a lot more naturally. So that's another kind of use. I always think the Data example's a really good one, rather than the Terminator stuff, kind of.
the friendlier end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
So you mentioned there, like alien data, sorry, translating alien languages and things. I know there's some work in Japan that I've seen, but is there any sort of differences between different languages in this sort of stuff?
Yes, definitely. Pronunciations and even regional dialects, like my Yorkshire accent, would be a huge factor of this. Again, I think that's why having a machine learning algorithm is the way to go, because these are sort of things you can train the system on. That is it's very interesting. It's something, again, I think I'd be really interested in looking at later on, to see what the influences of language and dialects and accents and things.
So what do you think, like, the time frame is for this sort of thing, like playing the long game? when are we going to be seeing, like you say, an interface, say, when am I going to have one in my home that can, you know, help, say, I don't know, maybe I'm elderly or I'm disabled or something, that sort of, you know, I don't want to say robot butler, but you know what I mean.
I do. Well, you might be in luck, because Hanson Robotics have announced, it was only a few weeks ago, that they're mass rolling out the Sophia robot. So that's their aim for 2021, 2022, is to start rolling out this Sophia model. But I argued that
right.
How useful that would be is kind of massively up for debate, because Sophia is actually semi-autonomous, not fully autonomous. So there's going to be certain things she can't do, you're going to have to do for her. And I think it might be too early to start even thinking about these sort of dishing humanoid robots out on a mass scale. At least until they can start doing things fully like themselves and without any human aid. And even then, you're still going to have to get it past kind of all the ethicists. There's a lot of really good work done in AI ethics and robotic ethics. It's really hard to say. I think it's a long way away. But at the same time, there's lots of good research going on at the moment, which is also pushing it forward. So it's very difficult to give you an answer to that.
Yeah, no worries. So yeah, that's been great. So you just mentioned earlier that now you're moving on to new projects. So I just wanted to ask you, you know, what are you hoping to work on next? What are your plans for the next few years?
Well, I'm at the moment working on what's called, visually enhanced common sense language models, which is basically allowing robots to use some level of human common sense. So an example of this would be if I had a robot and I had a vision system, and I asked it to find a pen on a table, it could do that no problem because it has object recognition and it could recognize a pen. But if the pen was in a drawer, say in a kitchen,
right,
and you asked it to find the pen, it would spend all day going around looking for something, but not ever opening the drawer. So this idea of common sense knowledge would be giving the robot some ability to know that pens are kept in drawers, clothes are kept in a wardrobe. And these are the things that are missing out. So it's like a cross between language and vision. There's like a crossover in our common sense, what we call common sense knowledge. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. And we're currently developing a robot to help people with cooking tasks. So it's like a robot chef to use in a kitchen. But you're able to ask it things and do things which you can't normally do with things like the Amazon Echo being an example. If you ask that to give you a recipe or help you cook, it gives you it in one solid block and it just reads the whole thing out. And this would be more intuitive. It'd be more like an information giver, information follower kind of construct, but also with lots of common sense knowledge bases embedded in there. So you'd be able to ask lots of things like, I don't have a certain ingredient. Is there another ingredient I could use instead of this? And it'd be able to do that as well.
Thanks for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please do leave us a review. This podcast was brought to you by the team behind BBC Science Focus magazine. In the March issue, which is on sale now, we talk to Tim Berners-Lee about whether we can make the internet great again. We look at the experiment looking to bring hallucinogenic drugs to the NHS. And we dive into plans to build a city on Mars. And of course, there's much, much more inside and on our website, sciencefocus.com.
Thank you for listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Science Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling Science and Technology Monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.